Hey, welcome back to The Firebreak. I'm Steve Wolf. The Firebreak is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing new technology for battling the most dangerous and damaging fires that are coming our way. And you know they're coming. I've got with us today Ron Rommel. Ron has got decades of experience in the fire service community, having served in many different positions, and has recently written a book called Axe It First. I gotta ask you about that, Ron. Tell me about your background. How did you get into the fire service? What brought you into it? And then we'll talk about why that has led you to think the things you think today.
Very good. Thank you very much for having me join your podcast here. It's a great opportunity to speak candidly about a very important issue that is facing everyone across the globe. So I got involved in forestry back in the late 1970s. I started on the Mount Hood National Forest of U.S. Forest Service. It's outside of the Portland area, about 35 to 40 miles to the southeast. It's a million-acre forest. Got started in the planning department and then also worked in pre-sale during that time, laying out timber sales. Also during that time, I was part of prevention, fire prevention and fire management. That was the years of the flying drip torch, we called it, as it was mounted at the base of a Bell jet helicopter. And we used it after we had logged off the various units that were prescribed during that time. Again, this is on the west side of the Cascade Mountain Range. And of course, the Cascades on the west side get a lot more precipitation and much more higher moisture content than they do on the east side of the range. So that was a lot of my experience. And then later on, I had an opportunity to work for a scaling bureau. It was a large scaling bureau as a third-party scaler. That was called the Southern Oregon Log Scaling and Grading Bureau, based out of Roseburg, Oregon.
Catchy name.
Yep. I became a senior scaler with them. Also helped to mentor and help in an apprenticeship with other scalers coming up in training as well. I had some really fantastic teachers there, a fellow by the name of Glenn Crabb. He was a master scaler. He actually started on the Columbia River back in the 1930s in water scaling. And later in his career, he became a master check scaler. And another gentleman, Carl Everett, was a master teacher, I must say, in the Bureau, and he was the person. If you ever had a question, he was there to help you answer that and put things right in your mind. So I had that, and then during that time, actually, I started and founded my own contracting firm that I used for timber evaluations and inventories. I started it out as part-time. Actually, I ended up working weekends, and I worked full-time scaling and helped local loggers in the community to verify cutouts on their properties. They just wanted to make sure things were kosher, things were the correct amount of volume that was coming out and the correct amount of defect. So my experience is very broad-based. Most recently, in the last 5 years, I've been working with an organization called the Walker Range Fire Patrol Association, and they're located in the Klamath Basin, the Klamath County of Central Oregon, which is basically just south of Lapine, Oregon. Lapine is about 40 miles approximately south of Bend, Oregon. One of our notable landmarks that we have is Mount Bachelor. For it's known for its powder snow for all the skiers and snowboarders. So it's been that icon for recreation for many decades. I remember that very well. As a child, I came over here with some friends and learned how to fly fish on the rivers surrounding the area. I was about 8-9 years old, and the community has definitely grown from the late 1950s up until our present day. Lapine probably had about 300 people. Today it has well over 2,000 people.
That's a little bit of growth.
A little bit of growth in the past 60 years or so, you know.
You're right. So what about wildfire changes? Has that...
Well, wildfire, you know, the biggest thing that caught my mind and about all of this is that in my lifetime, I'm 73 years old. I was born in 1950. So I've been around a while. And what led me to my book, Acts at First, was red flags all around the area, the lack of proper management, particularly on federal lands, U.S. Forest Service lands. They manage over approximately 50% of the land base of Oregon. They, in last three decades, since national forest property or policy has changed over that time, and we shifted more away from a timber base, from old growth logging, to a lot of second growth, third growth type of management. And unfortunately, the mindset at the time was more of a monoculture rather than a heterogeneous stand, which is more mimicking the natural state of nature. And that is how those stands have actually survived the remnant trees that we do have in our area, whether it's on the east side or the west side. They are centuries old. I'll just tell you right where I live, my property is right up against, I have about 290 feet of frontage right along the Bureau of Land Management property that was recently managed, and there had some, did some logging and thinning activities in the last 20 years. So a lot of those big trees, there's still a few remnants. I walk this every day, by the way. This is part of my exercise. I go out there and take a walk, clear my mind, and take a look around and see what's going on. Those trees are over three centuries. In fact, some of them are almost four centuries old.
Wow.
So it tells me that in the very beginnings, historically, that if we had catastrophic fires every year, they would have never reached that old of age, none of them. But that's not the case, and that's not how it worked in nature. It took eons of time. It took thousands and thousands of years, as we know it from the last ice age. I think there's a lot of information that substantiates that, that they evolved over time. And of course, during those times, as you go further back in time, you're closer to what that ice age effect was going on at that point. And today we're much further away from that. We are in more of a drought condition that is affected here, particularly in central and eastern Oregon, also on the western slopes of the Cascades, as it was defined by the 2020 and the 2021 fires that we had, the catastrophic fires. And my book was a collection of all of that information, as well as the intent of interviewing a lot of professionals on the ground. So I'm not a doctorate in forestry. I don't claim that. But what I do claim is that I've got lots of experience on the ground. I'm a big believer on boots on the ground, what you go out there and you see. So if you do a management and you see things and then go back, how did it work out? For instance, I'll give you just a little bit of information on the west side. When I worked for the Forest Service, oftentimes they were doing what they called shelter wood reproduction harvesting. So there were older trees in place, whether it was Douglas fir or array of western hemlock, but they would thin it out to a point to where there was just a few trees per acre. The problem was, is where you were in wind-prone areas, those trees would be laid over with a strong windstorm. So a lot of those techniques did not work based on root structure of the given species and just too much space where the roots normally, if they're tight enough, they interconnect and they hold each other up into the ground. But in those cases, we have that's prone wind, high wind coming through, and you just lays them down within a year or two after doing that application. So you learn a lot of things. You learn a lot of things, what happens on the ground. Fires, for instance, you know, fire is an important thing. It's a very important component in forests and grasslands. It's been around since the beginning of time here on Earth. And we had various things that would trigger those fires. Particularly over here in central Oregon, we have a lot of extinct volcanoes. And they say probably in the last 15 to 1700 years, we had some recent eruptions happening. So you can just imagine lava and hot ash igniting the forests that were around the area. And it was probably pretty devastating for the occupants who were here, Native Americans who had been in the area for several thousands of years. But the key difference between then and now is that there was no human infrastructure here. Zero. They were nomadic folks. So if they seen something that was, they're going to get burned up, they're going to pick up camp, and they're going to move. And they did that.
They didn't have a wooey then, right?
They knew.
You got to have an urban to have an urban interface.
That's right. So today, we're in a totally different era. You know, we're in the era of we harvested all these big trees, and it's a known fact that these big trees, they were able to evolve into stalwart giants. And when I did my research a little bit on the book here, and I investigated my hometown, for instance, Portland, it used to be called the Clearing. And before that time, it was in the early 1800s. And there are reports that the Douglas fir were in excess of 8 feet in diameter, 300 feet tall, and the first limb off of the forest floor was anywhere from 100 to 180 feet to the first limb.
Unbelievable.
So that tells me that these trees were able to survive fire when it came through, as it came through, on some sort of frequency, whatever was happening during the cycles of climate at that time. And a lot of those trees, you know, they were all in a state of different life. They were unavian ages. And you could see some, I seen some very early photographs, you know, photographic technology was just coming into its infancy in those early 1800s. And it wasn't quite refined really well enough until after the Civil War and during the Civil War. But some of those grainy photographs, you can see these large trees with broken tops, with delimbed at the top. In other words, the tops were dying out. They were at the end of their life cycle of several centuries. As a log scaler, just to give you a little extra information, I actually scaled wood that came through national forest properties and other properties that were 1,000 years old. I counted the rings myself. So they were huge logs. We're talking some 3, 4, 5, 6 feet in diameter, some larger, some smaller. And it all depends on the growing site as to where they're at, how well they grow. If they're in a poor site, they're going to grow slower and they're going to be smaller. But if they're in a healthy soil rich site, like the sandy loam along a river, then you see these bigger trees that can come up and just be these huge mess trees. It kind of reminds us in today's light about the redwoods along the California coast. And just a little caveat more of information, those redwoods once upon a time actually extended clear up into Coos Bay along the central Oregon coast and all the way down even further into California. They were massive in that area at one time. It was called the fog belt, where these trees could thrive in that area. And then we've got our giant sequoias, which is up in the Sierras and Kingston and over in that area. And you can tell now there has been some talk about that. I've commented on this on LinkedIn as well, because there was a gentleman, a doctorate, he had indicated that catastrophic fire is great for these things. Well, there's a limit to everything, including nature, as to they have been subjected to fire for centuries over and over and over. They're also affected by a beetle called the cedar beetle, and it's infecting their more and more and more. And the other fact is that their seeds in direct sunlight are only viable for about 20 days. So there's a very narrow window there as to how they're going to keep reproducing. So the argument was about whether or not we should replant. And I'm in favor that we should, because it's a national heritage for all of us. It's a learning opportunity for our youth to learn about the history of these giant trees and what they mean to our nation as a whole. So if we can keep promoting that, and under the Endangered Species Act, they definitely have the realm to protect that. It was only natural for me to comment in a positive respect that we should try to retain as much as we can. It's kind of like trying to understand and retain fire-resilient trees. So our drought conditions are increasingly getting worse and worse. I remember as a child, and my dad had raised horses, so I was taking care of horses. As a child, we helped build fence, clean a lot of stalls, a lot of scooping manure, you name it, I did it. But we always waited until July 4th and thereafter to actually bale hay, to go get the baled hay out of the fields. Because any time before that, the hay was too wet. And when it's too wet and you bale it, it becomes moldy. And when it becomes moldy, it's unfit for the animal to eat. So times have changed even more so. We used to get on Mount Hood a Timberline Lodge. It's a lodge that was built by the CCCs, the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s. And I remember as a child, this is back in the 50s, and the radio always came on and said, okay, at Timberline Lodge, we have 240 inches of snow. And this is November. And this is just before Thanksgiving. And every year, 220, 230, 240. It was over 200 inches. Today, they're lucky to get 60 inches, 100 inches. And it doesn't last. And also the other factor is a lot, when you don't have that consistency, these glaciers start to diminish. They start to retreat. So we've got a water issue there. This climate change is actually affecting so many variables. And as you get into forestry, we can understand. And after the effects of losing a lot of the older growth trees, nature continues to grow trees. So there has been a lot of transition from what we call a timber-based economy, like for instance, in the Bend area, the Bend, Oregon area, the Central Oregon area, and a lot of the Western states, to where we're going to more of a recreational-based economy system. But the problem is, our economy is made up by us. We create the economy. Nature creates nature. And the nature is that the trees keep growing. So nature doesn't care what we're doing while it keeps growing trees on and on and on. So what happened about 30 years ago, with the change of logging and not harvesting old growth in the name of trying to save the northern spotted owl. Eric Forsman is the key forester, worked on his doctorate, Oregon State University. I remember him, he's older than I am. And I think he had a recent interview here back in 2016. He said, you know, I may have overstated this just a bit. And because the barred owl has come in, and it's kind of taken over that habitat for the spotted owl. So, you know, nature will kind of adjust itself as to what species is going to be able to survive. This has been going on for millions of years on this planet Earth. So if we just kind of think of things and kind of put things in perspective and kind of get an idea, you know, history is a great teacher too. To kind of go back and look at history, and nature is the greatest teacher of all. But we just have to be cognizant of understanding nature and want to follow and try to mimic what she's doing out on a given right. site and areas.
Yes. So based on, you know, the history you've studied, you know, going back to the last ice age, and the history that you've witnessed.
Yes.
Going back to, you know, a 9-year-old fly fishing in the area, and the conclusions you've drawn from what you've learned and what you've seen, then going forward, what do our policies look like, ideally, if we would like to mitigate the megafire age?
Right. So the first thing that came to my mind when all this happened, I said, holy smokes. I drive up to Bald Mountain Fire Lookout. It's the tallest lookout in the state of Oregon. It's at 7,400 feet elevation. I have a view of 30 miles all the way around in radius, at least. And sometimes I can even see Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen from my location in Northern California. I can see the rim of Crater Lake. I can see the Mount Bachelor and the Three Sisters. are big icon mountains that are around the Bend area. I can see out to the desert of Fort Rock. Fort Rock area used to be a huge lake 9,000 years ago, 250,000 acres, deep water everywhere. Not there anymore. It's a desert.
Nope. It's all changing.
You can see there's a huge transition zone when you come from the west side of the Cascades, where you get more moisture from the ocean and from the storm activities that come off of and driven by the jet stream at various locations, wherever that jet stream is, and brings in a lot of moisture, particularly on the Oregon coast. You can get 100 inches of rainfall there, but as it hits into the west slopes of the Cascades, it might be down to about 60, maybe 70, sometimes 80. But then as it jumps over on the east side, barely 20, and in some cases only 5 for an area that normally gets 20, which was the area of what we call the Ponderosa Pine Zone. Ponderosa pine likes to grow in that area of a little bit better moisture. Also has a fair amount of a taproot that anchors it in the ground better than the cohort species known as the lodgepole pine, which is kind of an introductory species. It's kind of a, here I am, I'm growing real quick after a fire. I sprout up like grass. I'm very serotonous in my cones. They just pop like popcorn, you know? And the Ponderosa, it likes moisture in those cones to help pop it, but still you got to have some trees in closer proximity to spread the seed closer so we can propagate and grow more Ponderosa pine. So
what policy changes do we make?
Yeah. Policy changes that I think needs to be made is that we need to, number one, and this is in my book, Acts at First, we need to maximize our utilization of what we have. Wood is good. Wood is, it builds a nation, it builds homes, it builds all kinds of things that we use. It's malleable, it's workable. It's something that we all treasure to have. And to do it in a fashion to where we bring all the variety of natural resource professionals, whether you're a biologist, whether you're an ecologist, a botanist, whether you're a hydrologist, a geologist, all of the disciplines, and you're a fire specialist, a fire manager, and you are a firefighter, so that you understand what's happening on the ground and what we need to do. So there's still a lot of mitigation work to do. The thing is that people need to realize in today's light, we have a lot of high density forests across the landscape in the western states. Also here in Oregon, but it's Colorado, we have it Arizona, we have it all through. In fact, 100 million Americans are impacted by wildfire. And there's over trillions of dollars at stake here in value, in all the things that we cherish as a value, whether it's an infrastructure, whether it's the resort of Mount Bachelor, or if it's outside of Colorado, any of those resorts area. People love resorts. We like to have fun. We like to play. We like to enjoy. We like to hunt. We like to fish. We like to ski. We like to do all kinds of things out in the woods. So if we don't take care of what we have under our conditions today, we're going to continue to see these wildfires getting way out of hand. So let's mimic nature, because nature will, you reach a lifespan. The trees reach a lifespan. In the old days, there was nobody here really to carve them down like the Europeans did when they came to this country, or what's happened in Lebanon when they cut down the cedars of Lebanon to build great ships to go across the Mediterranean centuries ago. Everywhere humans have been, it has been somewhat of a path of destruction on nature. We really weren't geared to that. And I think the reason of that mindset is that we feared for our life during the time of the saber-toothed tiger. Can you imagine somebody or an animal like that grabbing your loved one and tracking it away and starting disemboweling it and eating it? It's pretty graphic the way I just said that. But I think that's probably what puts fear in us about nature in itself. There are even early Puritans thought nature was the doings of the devil. Oh my gosh, we got to We can't have that.
Right. I mean, an 18th century British garden is the absolute antithesis of nature, right? Everything in a row, ordered, a pond of this, of that, you know.
Right.
Nothing like a natural garden.
So utilization, I believe, is the key. Number one, wherever we can, there's going to be places where we cannot do that. Most of all, the management that was done on federal property was on areas that were manageable properties. Seldom to none was ever done in what we call designated wilderness areas. After the Wilderness Act 1964, those areas were really kind of off limits because they were so marginal to start with. The trees were smaller, they were less value, there was more disease, rot, and et cetera involved with those. They were more difficult to get to, logistic-wise was more difficult. But in these managed lands, which is yours, usually the lower lands, and they became, in the earlier days, they were part of the railroad lands, which became the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, or past the old railroad lands. And the BLM and the Bureau of Land Management was managed for timber production. It had been going on for years and years and years. Now we know that all those virgin timber, as we had was blessed with, we were basically handed to humanity. We didn't have to do anything. It was just here. And we took advantage of that. And right, wrong, or indifferent, we are here today because of those practices of taking probably too many of those trees that were kind of like the guardians of being more fire resilient out in the forest. And they naturally shaded out a lot of the lower vegetation, the understory, we call it. So they weren't able to crop up into brush fields as such. Oftentimes, forestry in the past had made mistakes. And I've seen those mistakes where we take too many trees. It's on a south-facing slope. It gets a lot of solar radiation. That soil starts to cook. And they start trying to hand plant trees in there, those seedlings die. It's like that. Soil temperatures over 160 degrees at some point, 120, 140, just they're sustained and not enough moisture, they die. So we have to learn from our mistakes. And I think if we look at nature just a little bit and learn from our mistakes, move forward and utilize what we can, set aside what we can't, but do it in a fashion that we check the boxes, of sound ecological science, sound fire management. Because if we check the boxes, one thing we don't have to do, we don't have to be perfect. Nature is not perfect. We are not perfect. And if we can get away from this concept that we have to do everything that this gentleman who happens to have a PhD on this and says that this and this and this and this needs to be done. Well, have you been out in the field and actually done this and this and this? I've been in the field, and part of my thing that I did in the field, I did a lot of forest inventory. I did forest inventory. In other words, it's kind of like when a bank has money in the bank, it's kind of like your money in the bank is all the trees that are on the ground. That's your inventory of what you have there. And you want to find out how healthy is that inventory? Will it sustain another rotation? Will it live? Is there something we need to do to treat? Is there something we need to do to enhance fire resilience? Is there something we can do as a human, since we're already here and we're here to manage things? And from a practical standpoint, let's do that. Let's think about how we do that. I don't know if you ever heard of Mr. Edward D. Deming. Deming philosophy, I learned this in business school. I got 2 degrees, one in forest, one in business. But I remember just signaling into Deming was the fellow, quite a statistician from the 1930s. In fact, General MacArthur had him go to Japan after World War II to help build up their industry and their quality assurance program. And he's been an icon in the business world and how to make things better. And you plan, You do, you check, and you act. You plan on something, you do it, then you check your work.
Right.
Off.
You gotta have that feedback cycle.
Yeah, that feedback. So you get on the ground, you check it. So we right. need to incorporate more of this philosophy in what we do in forestry and land management. It has been kind of isolated to the business world. When you're in a manufacturing setting and you're creating so many widgets of something and productivity and those kinds of things, I got to thinking about that over the years and I thought, what the heck? Why are we missing the boat on this? We've got to be able to
because
use
a
that.
Because a tree is not a widget.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? A tree is growing on its own schedule as exactly. is the rest of nature, and we have to work with it or we destroy it.
Exactly. So
Ron, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you sharing some of your wisdom here. And I absolutely, you know, recommend for anyone who wants to get a better understanding of the broader picture
yes.
of the role of trees in wildfires and how our right. management and mismanagement has right. put us in the spot we're in. Axe yeah. It First is the book. Ron Rommel is the office author. Ron, what's the best way for people to get a copy of your book?
So this book, Axe It First, this is a paperback, and it's available through a variety of book retailers throughout the United States and also internationally. They sell this in Australia.
Wow.
It's been sold okay. in France.
Except it's written backwards there, right? Okay. Ron, thanks so much for joining me.
It's available on Amazon as a Kindle ebook and also as a paperback. Yes.
Excellent. Ron, thank you so much. I hope you'll join me back here on the fire break.
Absolutely. Well, we can talk with a whole bunch of other information. I've got all kinds of stuff we can talk about.
I bet you do. I'm gonna turn to you frequently as a source of wisdom. There's a lot of knowledge out there, but not enough wisdom. So
wisdom.
Thank you so much.
We need wisdom.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Folks, you've been listening to a conversation here with Ron Rommel, author of Axe It First. Right here on The Fire Break, which is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative techniques and technologies for tackling the future's most destructive fires. Thanks for joining us here on The Fire Break. I'm Steve Wolf. Take care.